Welcome back to Balagan. In our previous episode, we shed light on Israel's democratic structure, checks and balances, and the lack of. When the democratic structure is so fragile, the role of the gatekeepers becomes crucial to ensure proper governance and keeping the rule of law. In recent years, Israeli politicians worked hard on weakening the gatekeepers, but it seems that now they do it with full power. What are they trying to do? How and what will be the implications? The judicial overhaul has four main changes the coalition would like to enact. The first one is to change the judicial appointment process. Second one, limiting the power of judicial review of legislation. The third, curtailing the status of legal advisors to the government. And last one, elimination of unreasonableness review of administrative actions. I know that it sounds Chinese, but for that, I'm glad to have again Dr. Ori Aronson to discuss and explain. So Ori, welcome back to Balagan.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
Where should we start? Maybe with the rule of law or the gatekeepers? Let's speak about who they are and what's their role.
I think it's best before we go into a breakdown of the specific reforms the government is trying to push to say something more general about, say, the general project of the government and how it should be understood in the context of the Israeli constitutional structure. As we mentioned in our previous conversation, Israeli constitutional structure is quite unique in the sense that it has relatively few effective institutional structures in place to check the power of government. In Israel, the government is elected from within the Knesset. It controls a majority of members in parliament as its coalition, and therefore the Knesset is considered a relatively weak check on governmental power. With the absence of other institutional features in place, basically the courts and legal professionals within government are the most significant elements in the Israeli structure that ensure that government remains subject to law. And this is indeed something more general that should be stated when we talk about the rule of law as kind of a fundamental notion of democratic governance. We usually mean that all elements of the state are subject to law, including the lawmaking institutions. So government, parliament are also subject to law, be it the constitution or some other form of a legal structure that limits their power. Otherwise, we're in a dictatorship. And Israel accepts the notion of rule of law as part of its constitutional structure. But obviously, rule of law to be effective has to have someone as, say, the speaker of the law. So it can tell the political institutions what the law says. Right? The law cannot just rule or govern on its own. Legal norms are abstract, and to be applied and understood and enforced, you need institutional bodies that would tell those subject to the law what it actually means, what it prohibits, what it enables. That is the role in any country of judges, of courts, and of legal advisors that operate within the executive branch. When an official wants to make an act or take an executive act, or a Knesset member wants to enact legislation, they need to know whether their plans are subject to the law, and the people in charge of telling them whether they are or not are legal advisors and judges. And if a government wants to, say, relieve itself of the rule of law or be free of the limits that the legal or constitutional structure pose, then we often see, not only in Israel, but in other countries as well, diverse attempts to limit the power of these players, of legal advisors and judges, basically making them weaker and turning their advice or analysis or interpretation of the law less restrictive or less compulsory on government. So we've seen this all around the world in places like Hungary, Poland, Turkey, India, Russia, other countries. In the past year, we see this with high intensity in Israel as well.
I want to ask you, because you know, you're mentioning governance and Israeli politicians, seems that this word became really popular among the coalition members. Do they have a base to their claim? I mean, who's stopping them from ruling?
So that's correct. When Justice Minister Levin came out with his plan in January, he actually called it the Fomat HaMishilut in Hebrew, or the, say, governmentability reform. Yeah. And of implying that the reason that governments cannot push forward policies they are interested in is that these pesky legal advisors and judges just don't let them do whatever they want. I think there is meager empirical evidence to support that claim. Whenever governments did want to push for serious policy reforms or moves in Israel's economy, in its social structures, in its security policies, very rarely was the court or legal advisors kind of these actors serious obstacles to those projects. In fact, if you try to count the times in which courts, legal advisors really managed to block serious policy moves by government, I think there are very few of those. We mentioned them in our previous conversation. One has to do with the exemption from the military draft for ultra-Orthodox, which is a big policy issue, and indeed blocked to some extent by the courts. And the other is the treatment of undocumented migrants into Israel. Again, a policy issue that really divided courts and politics. Beyond that, there are few serious policy choices governments have tried or sought to do over the years in which you can say, you know, this is a thing that just became impossible because legal advisors intervened. Often what legal advisors and courts do is try to help governments or political actors push forward their policies in a legal way. So in a way that would comply with constitutional requirements, that would not violate human rights in a disproportionate way, or that would be done through all of the required procedures by law.
You can literally see over the years that there were two, I would say, small minority groups in Israel that the Supreme Court bothered them the most. The first ones are, of course, the ultra-Orthodox that starting, I think the first big demonstration was in 1999 against, as you said, the drafting laws in Israel, when they were exempt and there was a strong movement against it, against their exemption. And the second one are the settlers that has an ongoing, I would say, romance with the Supreme Court, even though I will say that eventually the Supreme Court never really interfered with most policies in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. I haven't seen them stopping the settlements or talking against annexation. They just usually say this is legal or less legal and the government or the Knesset need to pass the right legislation for it.
Correct. So it's more about the procedure for doing whatever policy you're interested in. And indeed, when it comes to any policy regarding settlements in West Bank, Gaza Strip, basically the court very rarely interfered with what governments wanted to do. This applies both to establishing settlements in the West Bank. Again, we had one decision that had to do with keeping in place illegal settlements built on private Palestinian lands, which the court struck down, but then basically find a byway to allow most of these settlements to stay in place. Also, to the other direction, when the government decided to pull out settlements from the Gaza Strip, same thing, the court did not interfere there. So it goes both ways. And one of the interesting things now in Israel is many people sort of try to justify the current reforms by saying, you know, how come the courts did not help us settlers when we were evacuated from the Gaza Strip? But interestingly, so this was another case in which the court did not interfere, right, with the government policy, which is a more characteristic way to understand how the courts treat major policy decisions by government, be them on the right or the left.
By the way, he did not interfere with the government decision to withdraw from the Gaza Strip with the disengagement, but he did accept the settlers. They actually went and said that the compensation is not enough at one point. And the Supreme Court actually ruled in favor of the settlers and made sure that the state actually compensate the settlers with bigger compensation.
That's correct. The court actually said that the evacuation is only legal if the settlers receive proper compensation, and actually did intervene in that legislation to make sure that they do.
Once we said that, let's dive deep into the changes in the suggested reform that, you know, Yariv Levin actually said. I heard his speech a couple of days ago, and he starts it, by the way, by saying, as a Democrat who grew up on Menachem Begin's knees, he was his godfather, by the way, he knows that there are judges in Jerusalem. That's a famous quote by Menachem Begin. But on the other hand, he's trying to strike down the judicial powers. So let's talk about the reform.
I'd say it's true that the people pushing for the current reforms keep saying that they are motivated by their understanding of democracy. But this is a very, I'd say, base understanding of democracy, as if democracy is all about majority rule. There is no serious kind of scholarly definition of democracy that says, you know, whatever the majority wants, it can get. That's not democracy. Democracy is a political project founded on moral values, which have to do with liberty and equality. So whenever government promotes liberty and equality, it is, or is designed to promote liberty and equality, then it is worthy of the title democratic. If it's all about just we, the majority, want to exploit the rights of minorities, then even though you're a majority, that doesn't make you democratic to do that. And indeed, that's why any democracy worthy of its name includes checks and balances and limitations on the power of majorities, which the current proposed reforms are trying to scale back, basically. When we consider the first series of reforms proposed by government over the past few months, we can see, I'd say, three kinds of reforms, all directed at the same end purpose, which is basically to lift limitations on the power of governing coalition, basically to do as its will without legal or constitutional barriers. And the three kinds are, one is changing the identity of the people in charge of enforcing the rule of law. So we want judges who think like us, who have the same values as we do, and therefore, to the extent that judges or legal advisors employ discretion, that their discretion will be just to our side because they will be biased in favor of our policy position. So one has to do with the identity of the legal decision makers.
Politicizing the system.
But not only politicizing it, but also politicizing in a way that will ensure that the governing majority coalition will choose its own judges and legal advisors, right? So one thing is to say, you know, politics are going to be deeply involved in electing judges and legal advisors. Another is to say that the current government will be the one choosing the judges and legal advisors. So one has to do with the identity of the legal decision makers. The second one has to do with the changing the processes or the institutional structures of judicial review and legal review of governmental actions, basically to limit them, to make them less likely. So to make it harder for courts to strike down acts of government and parliament. So this has to do with the structure of judicial review. If those two are not enough, then also limiting the content of public law norms, basically saying it's not that we want our own judges, it's not that we want to limit the power of judges to strike down our acts, but it's also limiting the availability of norms or doctrines that the judges use in order to review the acts of government. And this is the reasonableness amendment that passed. So we see these three efforts that in combination, that if all manage to pass, combined will basically mean that Israeli government is nearly unlimited in its powers, kind of taking democracy to this extreme and based on the notion that whatever the majority wants, it can just get. So that's kind of a general overview, and then we can go into
yes,
different elements.
But you didn't mention the overhaul clause
That's the override clause. That's part of
the judicial review.
Judicial review, exactly. Yeah. So we can mention that as well.
Yeah, definitely. So let's start with the judicial committee.
Okay.
So in order to ensure your favorite judges to be nominated, what's the status today in the judicial committee? And actually, when they're talking about the process and who's going to nominate the judges, which judges are they talking about, if to be exact?
Israel has a relatively unique judicial appointment process, though over the years it has managed to create a comparatively respected judiciary. Judges to all levels of the Israeli court system are appointed through a similar process. There is a judicial appointment commission. It has 9 members, 2 justice ministers, so they belong to the majority coalition, 2 Knesset members, so 2 parliamentarians, often one from the coalition, another from the opposition, but not necessarily. 2 members of the lawyers' bar. So these are professional lawyers elected by the profession. And 3 Supreme Court justices, including the Chief Justice. So that's a 9-member committee. It includes 4, say, professional politicians and 5 professional lawyers or jurists, right? 3 justices and 2 lawyers. And that committee usually decides by regular majority on any appointment to all courts within the Israeli court system, except for appointments to the Supreme Court, which is the most significant court in terms of public and constitutional law, in which you need a majority of 7 votes to appoint a Supreme Court justice. This rule, which was passed in 2008 and has affected considerably the way Supreme Court justices appointment, basically means you need broad agreement between both politicians and professional lawyers to appoint judges to the Supreme Court. And that indeed has led to, say, a more diverse court than before. sometimes you get these quid pro quo deals in which, you know, the judges get one, the politicians get an appointment. Sometimes you get these compromise appointments of people who are sort of in the middle. And that norm of the special 7-member majority out of 9 is perceived by many to have worked relatively well in terms of creating a fairly diverse Supreme Court, diverse both in terms of kind of the social background of justices, you know, gender, religiosity, Ashkenazi, Mizrahi, Jewish, Arab to some extent, but also diverse in terms of, say, judicial philosophy and ideology. So now we have more justices who are kind of considered conservative as compared to liberals. So relatively diverse. And many people think this is a fairly reasonable way to arrive at a pretty balanced Supreme Court over time. The current Justice Minister, Levine, at some point said, I'm not pleased with that at all. The current system gives the judicial bloc, the 3 members on the committee, a sort of a veto power if they vote together, a veto power and appointments to the court. And the current government basically said, you know, we don't want to give the court any power in electing justices to the Supreme Court. We want this to be basically purely a political process. And not only that, we want government or the coalition, both justice ministers, both ministers from the government and Knesset members, to have a clear majority in the committee. So basically choose our own justices to the Supreme Court. And the proposal that has passed the first reading in the Knesset and is awaiting second and third readings before passage as a full law will give the governing coalition basically almost exclusive power to choose its own justices to the Supreme Court.
One thing that we forgot to say that you're mentioning that you need a majority of 7 out of 9. And this amendment is actually thanks to former Minister of Justice Gideon Saar, who originally comes from the Likud party when it was still considered to be a liberal right-wing party, less populist. And it was accepted with the blessing, actually, of the, if I remember, the Chief Justice.
Right.
I mean, there was a broad agreement about this change. And even, by the way, former Minister of Justice, Ayelet Shaked, didn't try to change the Judicial Election Committee's.
That's correct. And when we see the kind of, it's interesting to read sort of the justifications provided by government or government supporters in the media for these proposed changes now, kind of saying, you know, this court, it's only these left-wing elites and they're all members of the same clan and we need to diversify the court. Now, this might have been true, say, 20 years ago, but many things have changed since, including this amendment that now indeed has led to a much more diverse court. I think it's really difficult to say that the Supreme Court currently is made of kind of people from the same background. And it's safe to predict that if you let the current system work for another 5 or 10 years, the court will be even more diverse than before. The proposal being pushed by the government are, say, to some extent, really cynical because they're not about diversity. They're about giving complete control to the current government over the identity of Supreme Court justices. Now, again, this might seem relatively, say, you know, well, that's how it works in the States, doesn't it, right? The president kind of chooses his own appointees, but the differences are significant. First of all, as we know, the president needs the acceptance, needs the consent of the Senate, right? Yeah. Senate also has to approve, and the president cannot do that without the Senate. And we saw President Obama incapable of passing an appointment, right? He wanted to appoint Judge Garland, and he could not do that, right? Because he didn't have... Israel does not work like that. The government controls parliament, and therefore, it's basically whatever the government wants, it can push through and have... So there is no balancing institution there. In addition to the fact that, obviously, in the U.S., there is an entrenched, stable constitution, right, that limits what governments can do and what judges can do, right? They're subject to the constitution. Israel, we don't have that as well. Basically, if government controls legislation of basic laws, we mentioned that in the previous conversation, controls who the judges are that would interpret the basic laws. Basically, government controls the content of all constitutional law in Israel. That basically means only one branch controlling all governmental powers in the state.
And you can also see, based on the coalition's, I would say, work, mainly Yariv Levin, but not only him, that's their intention. I mean, Yariv Levin was saying, we want to make sure that we promise diversity. Then when you had, I think like a month and a half ago, the bar, the lawyers bar, had an election and the coalition actively supported Effie Naveh, who was an indicted lawyer, corrupted lawyer who already was the head of the bar. And once he lost to another lawyer named Amit Becher, who's a great guy, by the way, and talking about the ultra-Orthodox, and that's a small anecdote, in the year 2000, he was one of the leaders of Itorerut in Israel. That was awakening. That was the first movement of young people in Israel against the exempt of Haredim from the army. And I was banned from the Knesset along with him and another great guy, Itay Ben-Chorin. So that's a small anecdote. So once Amit Becher was elected, they said, okay, so now we need to expel the bar representatives from the Judicial Election Committee. We need to change the whole structure.
Correct.
And so that's like changing the rules of the game while you are playing.
That's exactly what it is. Basically, one of the proposals suggested by people opposing the current reforms is, if you have this principled position about how, say, judges should be appointed, then this is not supposed to be something for a specific government or for you. So why not suggest that whatever reforms you pass will only take effect in the next Knesset or within another 3 or 4 or 5 years, which is kind of a familiar means of constitutional design, kind of saying, you know, this is a long-term project. This is not about kind of immediate political gain. Therefore, you know, so take this seriously. But obviously, the government wants power now. And it's trying to make these amendments just to allow itself, right, to change governmental structures so that it will remain in power. Right?
Yeah, and Yariv Levin, by the way, is refusing to form this committee, to not to form, to bring it...
Right. So the Justice Minister, he's also the chair of the Judicial
of this committee,
committee, and he's unwilling to convene it under its current structure until he manages to pass legislation that will change it. That decision in itself is currently subject to a petition in the Supreme Court. So the court will review his decision not to convene the committee. We'll see what happens there. It's tied to the reasonableness issue, which we'll arrive at in a minute.
Yeah, so that was the Judicial Election Committee and the changes in the appointment process. Now let's talk about limiting the power of the judicial review of legislation, because we did mention it.
Right. So in the previous conversation, we mentioned that since the 1990s, the Supreme Court decided that it has the power to strike down legislation if it violates basic laws in a way that does not comply with the terms of the basic laws themselves, basically turning us into a full constitutional system in which the courts are the enforcers of the constitutional structure. This has been met with opposition over the years, kind of saying, you know, we never chose this. The Supreme Court kind of decided on its own. Not go into that, but as we mentioned in our previous conversation, for over a generation, this has worked in a relatively stable way. And the court, once every while, struck down a piece of legislation and through politics complied. The proposals currently on the table suggest limiting that power of judicial review significantly. First of all, we're not going to go into that in detail, but there's a bunch of suggestions saying, you know, that if the court wants to strike down a law passed by the Knesset, it can only do this in a very unique and complicated procedure. It has to convene all of the justices of the court, all 15 justices. This is against kind of the customs of the court. And it has to do it in a very big majority. And there's all kinds of special procedures that are basically going to make it very unlikely for the court to strike down legislation. But more significantly for our purposes, and this is also relevant to a petition currently before the court, the government also suggested eliminating completely the power of the Supreme Court to strike down basic laws. Now, why this is interesting? So, as we mentioned, since the 1990s, we treat basic laws as our constitutional texts. Obviously, you might say, and in the US, this is kind of a very accepted perception, that the Constitution is above all of the branches of government, including the court. And you cannot imagine the Supreme Court striking down, say, an amendment to the US Constitution. That's true. But in Israel, the case is a little different. And I recall that to legislate basic laws or to amend our basic laws, basically you need a normal majority and a normal legislative process in the Knesset, which means that government controls that. So basically, if you eliminate the power of the Supreme Court to strike down basic law legislation, well, you kind of tell the government, you know, if there's anything you want to immune from judicial review, it's very simple. You pass it in normal majority in Knesset, majority you control because you have the coalition vote, and just call it basic law. So just put in the title the words basic law, and therefore it's immune from judicial review. Now, this was in essence true even before the current government. What we see now is the government is starting to exploit this power and insert into basic laws contents that have nothing to do the kind of the broad purposes of a constitution to structure rules of the game that are fair for both sides, do not give an undue power or advantage to one side or another. And the implication will be basically that a free-for-all, you know, whatever the government wants, just put in basic law and the Supreme Court and the courts will not be able to review that. Over the past several years, the court has developed kind of initial stages of a doctrine allowing it to review basic law legislation because we started seeing governments kind of exploiting that power and putting into basic laws contents that have to do with sort of immediate political gain and not with sort of constitutional content. And right now, basically the biggest case on the court's docket currently, which is it's going to hear oral arguments on September 12th before the largest panel ever convened on the Supreme Court, so 15 justices, which is a challenge to an amendment to the basic law that has to do with the reasonableness doctrine, which we'll mention soon. And there the court is kind of signaling that it's going to take very seriously its power to strike down basic law legislation. Interestingly, the government now says, even without passing any legislation, it's already stating that the Supreme Court has no power to strike down basic laws. So if in January they proposed a draft legislation that would state that in law, now they're even sort of skipping that part and saying, you know, even without legislating that the Supreme Court cannot do that, that's our position. And indeed implying that we might not respect or might not comply with a decision of the Supreme Court to strike down basic law legislation, which is very problematic, right? Again, because basically the government can put anything it wants in basic law. And we already see some drafts of some ideas of what might be included in these basic laws once they are exempt from judicial review. So for example, we mentioned several times the exemption from the draft for the ultra-Orthodox. This was struck down by the court many years ago.
Three or four times.
Correct. Saying, you know, that this was done in regular legislation that violates the constitutional right to equality and therefore it cannot stand. So now the coalition says, you know, so here's a simple solution. We'll just create a basic law exemption from a military service for ultra-Orthodox. And if basic laws are exempt from judicial review, that's it. You know, problem solved. We don't need to. Or another proposal to enact a basic law that would allow all of these extremely draconian measures against undocumented migrants and asylum seekers. The court strikes them down as regular pieces of legislation that violate rights to human dignity or to liberty. No problem. We'll just put them in basic law and they will be immune from review. So the risk here is very palpable. And therefore, of eliminating that power could be really basically take the court out of the picture of judicial review in Israel.
It's connected in a way to our topic because we have the basic laws, but for some reason, Israel never got to enact basic law of legislation. Tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll go back to the judicial reform. Because it's really interesting that you have, I think, 18 or 19 basic laws, technically.
Yeah.
And none of them deals with the rules of the game. That's the fundamentals of a constitution.
So that's one of the kind of quirks of the Israeli constitutional system. As we mentioned in our previous conversation, the plan was already early on to establish a full constitution. That did not work. So they opted for the series of basic laws. And there was kind of a general understanding that the last basic law within this series will be kind of tying all of them together with what they call the basic law of the legislation that would formally treat all of the previous basic laws as part of the constitution and would also officially state the norms of constitution making and will make it harder for just regular majorities to change constitutional texts. Now, like many things in Israel, even though there were several attempts over the years, beginning in the 1970s and all the way to even the previous government had a bill proposing this basic law legislation that would arrange all those issues, the rules of the game, those never managed to pass every time because the people that had to make these choices were politicians with immediate short-term political interests. People making those decisions were often politicians with short-term political interests, and those often do not align with limiting the power of current majorities, right? And establishing these rules of the game that would apply to also even if I was in the minority or in certain future long-term scenarios. So we are kind of living in this odd constitutional system that treats basic laws as supreme constitutional texts, even though we still don't have kind of the general norm that would treat them as such. Whenever people like me or other sort of constitutional scholars manage to take a break from fighting the reforms, And we're also trying to think about possible futures or where this could lead us. And then we have now kind of this resurgence of new suggestions or proposals for perhaps now everybody is so intent on this. And there's a general understanding of the importance of the issue. Possibly, if we manage to withstand this current attack on democracy, maybe this will lead to another moment in which enacting kind of a full basic legislation might be possible.
I don't know how we're going to come up with that. Seriously, I come out from this crisis with the current coalition. I don't see them enacting such a law to set fair rules of the game. So we discussed two elements of this reform, and we have two more to go. The next one, once again, is the status of the legal advisors, you know, the gatekeepers. You were mentioning it before. First thing, who are the gatekeepers that we're talking about? What are their roles? And also, what are some of the flaws that you see in the system now?
Like in any other bureaucracy in the world, Israeli government ministries, agencies, all have legal advisors. In Israel, these are members of the civil service. They're not judicial appointees. They're part of the basically infrastructure of the legal advisorship to the government, headed by the attorney general, who again is not a political figure, but rather a civil servant appointed for a long period of time. So a six-year tenure, which transcends the tenure of any government in Israel, right? So this is considered a professional job. And the legal advisors to the different ministries and agencies within government are professionally subject to the attorney general. So it's a professional hierarchy. And the role of these legal advisors is basically to be kind of the immediate speakers of the law to all government officials. So say I'm a minister and I have a policy plan I want to push through, you know, whatever, be it about transportation or welfare, or education and whatnot. I am required to do that by law and according to the procedures and norms stipulated by law. But I'm a political figure. I need someone to tell me what the law requires from me, right? So like if I'm a transportation minister, I want to build a bridge somewhere, I have to go to an engineer.
Are you sure they need it?
Well, if we accept the notion of the rule of law, then that should go without saying. So if I want to build a bridge, I'm going to go to the official engineer of the Ministry of Transportation. But if I need to hire some service, I'm going to go to the official lawyer of my unit, the legal advisor, who would tell me, no, this is a procedure you have to go through. This would be the legal way to go about to achieve your policy goals. That's the main role of legal advisors, basically telling government officials how to accomplish their goals legally. So what's the legal way to do what they want? That's kind of like lawyers do in private companies as well. Obviously, at some point, legal advisors could come in conflict with plans or choices that policymakers make within ministries or agencies. For example, when an official wants to pursue a policy or take an act that is prohibited by law.
Or to make an appointment to nominate somebody who's not
eligible,
doesn't have the, you know, exactly.
Correct. Doesn't have the
relevant experience or background. Right.
So in those cases, the role of the legal advisor would be to say, you know, this is just illegal. You cannot do that. This is not allowed. Now, what happens if the decision maker doesn't care and says, I'm still going to go forward with that? Well, then you can go to court. And then the judges will again review the position of legal advisor, of the policymaker, of the decision maker, and decide whether that's legal or not. So the courts always have the final word. But obviously, you cannot take every such dispute to the courts. This would basically
will never end
the court system. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's why the legal advisors are kind of the first line of defense for the rule of law before you arrive at courts. And they're entrenched in the different units of government, the ministries and the agencies. And they do this work, day-to-day work, vis-a-vis the different decision makers saying, you know, this is the way to do what you want legally. Or in these extreme cases in which you're saying this is just illegal, you cannot go forward with that. And if there's a dispute that's unresolved, then yeah, we'd find our way to court. That's why they are significant actors, and that's why government also is going after them. There was a proposal. It hasn't been pushed forward yet through Knesset, but it's been presented by the government to say in law that the legal advice of these civil servant legal advisors is not mandatory.
It doesn't bind them. It's just a recommendation.
Exactly. It's a recommendation.
Yeah.
And we can decide differently without changing the law, right? It's not like, okay, so I heard what you said. I'm going to enact a different law or change the rule in a way that will make it legal because obviously I have the power. I can access political power to change the norms. I'm just disregard this, you know, and I'm the minister, I'm the bureaucrat. I have a different understanding of the law, and therefore I'm just going to go and do what I wanted, regardless of what the legal advisor said. Now, sometimes these disagreements can make sense. Some of the advice is not about the exact procedure of how to do things, but it's more about discretionary questions of whether this is proportionate, whether there's a due diligence and stuff like that. And you could say, you know, I disagree with the legal advisor's position on that. Often such disagreements are resolved on a higher rank and the solution is found. It's very rare that you have this complete clash, say, between the decision maker and the legal advisor that is completely unable of being resolved at some level. But you could say, you know, these are political figures. We want their discretion to apply. But on a day-to-day sense of the operation of the executive, it's just inimaginable to think that whatever the lawyers say will just be treated as a recommendation. I mean, this is a complete invitation to corruption of the whole public service in Israel and could really lead to complete the deterioration of the quality of governance in Israel. So it's quite concerning in the sense of just the quality of government in Israel. And you can think of countries that have these sort of failed democracies, which corruption takes over the public service. So this could indeed be the result of such a move in Israel.
אורי, סלח לי שנייה רגע, אני מתנצל שוב רגע. Technically, what you're saying makes sense. When we're talking about reasonable or unreasonable, you know, nominating unqualified people, like some of the cabinet members already did, is completely unreasonable. Like putting, let's put it aside that putting Itamar Ben-Gvir as the Minister of Security, or now National Security, used to be Interior Security, and putting as his, I would say, Chief of Staff, somebody who was investigated by the Shin Bet is unreasonable. Or putting somebody in the Office of Transportation by Miri Regev, somebody with no experience now controlling budget of billions, only to make sure that he's giving the right people to win contracts, is completely unreasonable. But that takes us to the last highlight of this judicial reform, which is eliminating unreasonableness review of administrative action. How are they planning to do that?
So this is actually the first part of the reform that managed to pass fully. So it was enacted by Knesset a few weeks ago. So of all of the proposals we mentioned, each one is a different stage of legislation in Knesset, but the reasonableness amendment actually already passed by the mere votes of the coalition alone. So basically no support from other parties.
64-0,
right? In the final reading, the opposition boycotted the final vote. But this is important to note because, again, we're talking about a constitutional amendment, right? So this is an amendment to basic law of the judiciary. What in any other country would require broad agreement and kind of a long-term perception of the good of the country, again, passed by the mere votes of a coalition, basically for its own immediate political benefit. So what the amendment basically says, courts would not be authorized to hear cases, let alone decide cases that challenge the decisions of the government, prime minister, or the ministers for reasons of unreasonableness. So that's basically what it says. And it even includes an explicit statement saying, and that includes decisions about appointments and also includes decisions not to exercise authority, which ties into what we mentioned earlier, the decision of the justice minister not to convene the judicial elections, judicial appointment committee. So this is also explicitly kind of protected by this last piece of legislation. So would you say a few words about what the reasonableness or unreasonableness doctrine in Israeli administrative law is? So this is a doctrine that has its origins in age-old British administrative law. It's not an Israeli invention. It took several changes or developments over the years, and since the 1980s, got its sort of modern form in Israeli administrative law, which says, basically, courts can review decisions of administrative actors, governments, ministers, bureaucrats, officials, for unreasonableness, meaning if the decision maker failed to grant proper weight to all of the relevant considerations that it was supposed to consider in exercising its authority. So what would that mean? Say, you know, I'm a local official or have the power to decide on giving a permit for a business. And when I decide that, I have to take into account both, say, the economic activity in my town. But I also need to take into account issues of, say, noise or...
Yeah, the public interest, whatnot, right? I would say.
All of those other public interests. And I just disregard those other considerations. I consider only or give most weight to a certain consideration, for example, economic activity, and I give no weight to other relevant or required considerations. I disregard them. That will be deemed by Israeli administrative law as an unreasonable decision, not because we don't like the decision or its result is incorrect or it's a bad policy. That's not the content of the review. The review has to do with the quality of the decision-making process. So whether the decision-maker, in fact, took into account all of the relevant considerations and gave them due weight. Now, it's not like this is not a simple thing to decide. Obviously, there is some discretion involved in this. What are the relevant considerations? What is the comparative due weight of each one of them? But that's why when the courts review decisions for unreasonableness, they don't just strike down any decision they think that was not exactly decided correctly or in a correct way, but rather only when there is what the law calls extreme unreasonableness. So when petitioners can show the court that there was a relevant consideration and was basically completely disregarded, which brings us close to common law doctrines of arbitrariness. Basically, when you see a government completely flouting rational discretion, saying, you know, I care about only this and I don't care about all the other considerations. This is when the court would say, well, you know, here, you're not allowed to do this. The people have a right to rational governance. They have a right to require from the government that it takes account of all of the relevant considerations when it exploits its governmental power. And when we can show that it failed to do that, then the court will strike down those decisions. This doctrine has been applied in several contexts over the past years. One relatively more contentious line of decisions by the Supreme Court had to do with appointments. The decision of a prime minister to appoint a minister in complete disregard of the fact that he's been proven corrupt and facing criminal charges.
And he promised that he will not come back to politics. Correct. That was the agreement between him and the court.
So, Crank, discounting all of that is completely unreasonable. You have to show that you took that into account, that somehow that was part of your considerations when you made that choice. And if you can't show that, therefore, the decision will be unreasonable. Obviously, that makes it for a lot of sort of political complications, right? Because politicians don't like to be told, you know, this is the thing you're not allowed to do, or here are some considerations you have to take. The legislation passed is quite broad, right? Because it basically says any decision. Some earlier draft said, you know, only decisions have to do with general policy or with security measures, whatever. No. So now it's any decision taken by any minister. And ministers in Israel basically also have the power to decide for the bureaucrats subject to them. So basically, you know, if there is an official within my ministry who is authorized to make a certain decision, and I'm the minister, I can just now say, you know, from now on, I'm the organ making those decisions. So basically, this allows any governmental decision to be exempt from reasonableness review. Or again, in the Israeli context, it's extreme unreasonableness review, which could potentially open up the way for more corrupt, more arbitrary, more capricious decisions by the court, basically less justified or less accountable, which is a more important thing, right? Basically, it would be harder for us to demand from our ministers, from decision makers, to explain how they arrived at decisions and whether they took into account all relevant considerations. So that has passed as a exemption from court review. It's not even an explicit statement from now on, ministers do not have to act unreasonably. That would have looked odd. What they say is, no, all norms are the same, but the court just cannot say that. And again, these are all of these kind of awkward ways to exempt the political branches from review by professional legal institutions. And taken as a whole, combined with the other measures we already mentioned, what you get is a government basically uninhibited by law almost completely.
It's amazing that at least the ultra-Orthodox who voted in favor of this amendment, they were the last one who won a case in court against the government when the former government, the Minister of Finance, Victor Lieberman, was trying to change the criteria for stipends, which was the ultra-Orthodox out of this
deal. Right, for some welfare payments, right.
Yes. Yeah. And they went to the Supreme Court, which said that this is unreasonable.
Correct.
And now they voted in favor of this amendment. And I'm saying it sadly, but I think that the ultra-Orthodox will be the first one to get the backlashes from the public who's opposing the judicial overhaul. And I don't know if it's a blind spot for them, but that's something political and it's less relevant to our conversation. But I just wanted to bring it up that actually for current coalition members actually got the benefit of using or winning a case in court thanks to the unreasonableness clause. But what can I say, Oria? I mean, first thing, thank you very much for your time. There is a lot more to discuss about the judicial overhaul. The Knesset is now on a break until after the high holidays. They worked hard. In September, we have some appeals against the coalition and we'll see what will come up with that. We need to discuss the status of the Supreme Court and what will be the ruling, because they are actually now in an impossible stage. I mean, no matter what the ruling will be, they will be either slammed by the coalition to prove their point that it doesn't let them do any governance, or they will be slammed by the people who support the rule of law, telling them, you guys are not being the gatekeepers we expect you to be.
That's right. I would say just one thing. It's true that many of the protesters are expecting the Supreme Court to kind of take care of the situation and strike down some of these measures. I would say that perhaps one of the counterintuitively optimistic aspects of the major protests we've had in Israel over the past several months is that people are starting to realize that this is not so much in the hands of institutions, including courts. This is actually in the hands of the people themselves. It is actually quite likely that the court will disappoint many of the protesters, at least in some of its decisions or in the extent that it would be willing to go. But what we need to remember is that the people themselves managed to take into their hands these questions and say what we would actually mostly want is for the citizenry, right, to remain interested and involved, not so much expect institutions to make the decisions for them. So, but this is for another conversation, I agree.
Oh, definitely. Eventually, they need to remember that it all starts and ends with politics. But that's definitely for another conversation. Ori, thank you very, very much for sharing with us and enlightening us. And it was a pleasure of having you here. Let's hope for better days in Israel.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
If you found this episode enlightening or thought-provoking, be sure to subscribe to Balagan on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And hey, if you're feeling extra generous, leave me a review. Your feedback means the world to me and helps others to discover the show. Of course, sharing the episode link with others will also be greatly appreciated. Remember, the conversation doesn't have to stop here. Join me on Balagan's Facebook group to continue discussing today's episode and connect with fellow listeners. I would love to hear your thoughts, questions, and suggestions for future topics. You are more than welcome to check my website, www.balaganil.com, for additional resources. I'm committed to connecting you with Israel and providing you with proper context. Until the next time, remember that knowledge is power. Keep learning, keep growing, and continue engaging with Israel. I can't wait to catch you in the next episode of Balagan.